Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Stuff to blow your mind, New York Comic Con, Stranger Things. Yes, it all comes together on October 6th from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at Hudson Mercantile in Manhattan. If you're in the area, join us for Stuff to Blow Your Mind live Stranger Science as we explore the exciting science and tantalizing pseudoscience underlying the hit Netflix show Stranger Things. Stuff You Missed in History Class has a show right after us in the same venue, so you can really double down on your stuff. And hey, the three of us would love to meet you. This is the opportunity to do it. Learn more and buy your tickets at NewYorkComicCon.com/NYCC-presents.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager.
And this week, we're talking about Timothy Leary. Now, we're not just going to talk about Timothy Leary. We're also going to talk about the science of LSD, the history of LSD, the use of LSD and psilocybin in various research projects, what these substances actually do to the mind, to the brain. But we're going to use Timothy Leary as kind of a, you know, sort of a guiding principle, I guess, for this episode. And if you're out there and you're thinking, well, I love Timothy Leary, well, then strap in. If you're out there and you're thinking to yourself, well, I don't know that I like this Timothy Leary guy, well, strap in as well.
Yeah, I think we've got something for everybody here. We were basically sheltered during a hurricane this week, and so Robert and I just binge read about Timothy Leary for 4 days straight. We've got a lot to share with you. My eyes are bleeding a little, but I think you're going to be interested in this, so much so that we're going to do this as a two-parter.
Yes. Now, just to refresh anybody out there and to inform anyone who doesn't know who Timothy Leary is, well, Timothy Leary was an American psychologist, author, and a key figure of the 1960s counterculture and psychedelics, movement in general. He lived 1920 through 1996, and he managed to run afoul of pretty much every organization he was a part of. He was arrested enough times that he supposedly saw the inside of 36 different prisons. He earned the ire of many Americans, even as he was able to cement a reputation as also kind of a counterculture leader. And I think the reason is because he has this message of inner exploration, of anti-establishment thinking, and this resonated with folks and continues to resonate. His writings, his soothing sage-like voice on numerous audio recordings, his irresistible celebrity allure, it all made him just impossible to ignore, love him or hate him. Plus, he was not the sort of guy to let the limelight go away.
New.
and we'll get into all that. He clung to it, and people gravitated to him as well. He was more than willing to rub elbows with scientists like Carl Sagan, artists like H.R. Giger, performers like John Lennon, and, you know, such luminaries as Allen Ginsberg, Aldous Huxley, William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac, and Ken Kesey. He even kept the company of former enemies when it benefited him, such as Watergate burglar and later conservative radio talk show host G. Gordon Liddy.
Yeah, so this guy has been widely influential. He was I have a derogatory saying that I say sometimes about people like Leary, although I think Leary was doing this before this guy. He was the Cato Kalin of his time. Like, he was famous for being famous.
He was, yeah.
It wasn't because of a very specific thing he did. And we learned this through the research, but I have to be honest that, like, my experience with him was basically thinking, oh, this was an academic who had done some studies and then sort of became a guru-like figure, much like Sasha Shulgin when we talked about him during our two-parter on MDMA. Now, Sasha Shulgin was a practicing chemist who was in his laboratory up until he died, right?
Yeah.
Leary was not. He did do some interesting studies in the 50s and 60s, and we're going to get into all of that stuff. But first, I think we should probably talk about his influence on music.
Yeah, I have to say that before I knew anything about Timothy Leary, I knew the Moody Blues song Legend of a Mind.
Okay.
It has the chorus, Timothy Leary's dead, you know.
Yeah.
And so forth. Wonderful, wonderful track. I listened to it several times while researching this episode. Music fans out there might recognize the sampling of his voice in various recordings, probably most notably a live version of Tool's Third Eye, where they have the bit, think for yourself, question authority. And then you'll find numerous other musical projects that make use of his soothing voice. And in fact, he was involved in several of these projects as well. There's an ambient instrumental, like sitar distortion album titled Turn On, Tune In, Drop Out, which is one of his catchphrases.
Yeah.
And that's actually, like, really good listening. I fire it up every now and then. You just kind of, you know, chill out and you know, don't think about what's being said too much. But the interesting thing, as we've alluded to, is that there is this kind of surface-level pop culture idea of Leary.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily hold up when you start going into the details of who he was, the sorts of research projects he was involved in. I really wanted him to be more in line with another counterculture, controversial character that we've talked about, John C. Lilly.
Right.
But there's not really a lot to compare the two besides the LSD connection.
Right. And that's actually kind of what's happening with this episode, is we're getting a convergence of two types of episodes that we normally do. Mm-hmm. We have a history of doing these two-parters on specific psychedelics and looking at their scientific and medical applications. But then we also have a history of doing episodes like the John C. Lilly one or the Sasha Shulgin one. We call them our psychedelic Avengers. And we thought, oh, we're going to merge Tim Leary and this LSD psilocybin research together, and it'll be really interesting. It turns out that he wasn't actually contributing to the research, but I think it does come together in a really interesting way thematically when we get to the whole piece of this. And in that, I think he was a barometer for America's acceptance of the idea of researching acid as being a medical tool.
Yeah, it's interesting how he was, as we'll just discuss, he was a spokesperson for this. He represented supposedly a learned academic who was advocating LSD as this powerful tool. And yet at the same time, he also was such an inflammatory individual as part of the counterculture. He, a lot of people point to the harm he did as one of the key figures, more so than John C. Lilly, who vilified the counterculture and vilified the use of psychedelics. And one of the reasons that psychedelics were not studied for decades.
Yeah, there are multiple researchers in the notes here that we'll talk about throughout the course of these two episodes who point to Leary as being the reason why we haven't been able to use LSD in medically approved studies for what, going on 30 plus years now.
Yeah.
Longer than that, I think even. It was, well, it's in the notes here somewhere, but it was in the mid 60s when it was banned. Yeah. So yeah, strap in, because that's the other thing. We're going to get into a real basic primer for you on what LSD is, what's the difference between LSD and psilocybin, and then we'll roll into the Leary experience.
Okay. So to go back to the very beginning here. Let's just go to the origins of LSD itself, since that's the, you know, the main substance that we're going to be discussing here.
Yeah.
So Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann synthesized LSD in a Sandoz pharmaceutical lab on November 16th, 1938. Sandoz was working on a research project involving a parasitic fungus called ergot that grows on rye. Now, you may remember that Joe and I recorded an episode titled The Psychedelic Nightmare of Ergotism that dealt with ergot, and that is the same substance that we're discussing here. And, you know, aside from noteworthy and truly horrifying breakouts of ergot poisoning in Europe, it has been linked to various supernatural rites as well as allegedly individual artists and artistic traditions throughout history, though I think sometimes those are mere theories.
Right, yeah. And so just to be clear here, Sandoz was a pharmaceutical company that started in 1886, and they began researching for more novel kind of drugs in 1917. They were basically looking for therapeutic leads based on natural products, so they turned to ergot. Why? Well, they had an example that they'd already created called ergotamine that was a drug that they had created for treating migraine headaches. So Hofmann came along, and he started looking at ergot, and he saw the lysergic acid in it, and he thought, well, maybe this LSD that I can synthesize out of this will be a good respiratory stimulant. So, for instance, maybe if you have asthma, you take some LSD and it'll help you breathe better.
Yeah, so he ended up deriving different compounds from lysergic acid, and he developed several medicines, including drugs that lowered blood pressure and improved brain function in the elderly. And in 1938, he derived the 25th in a series of these derivatives. It was lysergic acid dithalamide, or LSD-25. And he thought that LSD-25 might stimulate breathing, circulation, but tests didn't show anything special, and Sandoz abandoned further study. But then 5 years later, Hoffman's thoughts returned to LSD-25's potential, and he felt that it hadn't been fully explored. So he took the perhaps unusual step of synthesizing another batch for further testing, and during the process, he began to feel strange. The rest is history. He discovered the properties of LSD-25, and I've heard it described as his problem child. Like, it basically, the rest of his life, he kept coming back to LSD and trying to figure out, like, you know, what it can be used for and how, right, you know, what are the true properties of this. At the same time, there's this kind of roller coaster of cultural awareness of it taking place in the background.
Yeah, yeah. And he had that infamous bicycle ride as yes. well right after he takes it for the first time that has been sort of mythologized over the years.
Yes. Now, LSD, to be clear, is a psychedelic drug, meaning that it alters perceptions of reality, the shape of thoughts, the connections that one forms. I can't stress enough that one should set aside any cinematic ideas of what acid trips consist of, because it's rare to find a film that truly feels trippy in a way that matches up with the actual experience of LSD. You don't see imaginary elves or anything. If you watch just films and TV, you just assume that an LSD trip is a dream sequence, and a dream sequence is just an LSD trip, that these are interchangeable altered states of reality.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I remember, like, growing up when kids would start talking about LSD and it being available to us, just all the, like, various, like, bizarre urban myths that people would tell, you know, like, oh, there's this one guy who took it and he thinks he's an orange now and he doesn't know how to stop being an orange. Or, like, another one was like, this guy took it and he saw a bunch of, everybody looked like giant white gorillas to him, and he fought all these gorillas. And it's like these sort of spectacular stories, while it does have hallucinogenic properties, they're mythologized.
Yeah, I always think back to an episode of Strangers with Candy where there's a story of a girl who took LSD and tried to force herself through a keyhole.
Right. You know?
Now, that's not to say that that nothing bad can happen while one is on LSD. We'll have some examples of that as we go on here. But in terms of just like what the experience of LSD, that basically what is a psychedelic experience, oddly enough, I want to turn to the words of Timothy Leary.
Okay.
Because I thought that he actually managed to sum it up rather nicely here. And I'm going to go ahead and read it in my impersonation of Timothy Leary, because it's more fun that way for me, and hopefully for you. Of course, the drug dose does not produce transcendent experience. It merely acts as a chemical key. It opens the mind, frees the nervous system of its ordinary patterns and structures. The nature of the experience depends almost entirely on set and setting. Set denotes the preparation of the individual, including his personality structure and his mood at the same time. Setting is physical, the weather, the room's atmosphere, social, feelings of persons present toward one another, and cultural, prevailing views as to what is real. It is for this reason that manuals or guidebooks are necessary. Their purpose is to enable a person to understand the new realities of the expanded consciousness, to serve as roadmaps for new interior territories which modern science has made accessible.
So to give you an idea of what LSD is like outside of the experience, outside of getting turned on, as Leary would put it, right? It starts within about an hour of when you first take it, and it can last up to 12 hours. There's a peak about halfway through that experience, and the effects vary widely, but biologically, they include dilated pupils, increased blood pressure, high body temperature, dizziness, sweat, blurred vision, and tingly hands and feet. The primary effects, though, are visual, which is more what Leary is describing there. You get stronger colors, brighter lights, trails, halos, and patterns. Overall, people say it provides a sense of happiness and euphoria that's very emotional. However, though, as we said, this can also lead to impulsive behavior and poor judgment when you're under the effects of this euphoria.
Yeah, you feel your body as if it's something new, something different. You smell and taste the world in a different way. Visual stimuli is processed with new areas of focus, new details, and the same can be said for cognition. And the same can be said for the basic processing of time. And so indeed, that is the essential psychedelic experience, in a nutshell.
And there's one thing I'd like to point out before we go further here, which is that we don't actually know how it affects the brain entirely. And why don't we know that? Because there's never been any scientific research on how it affects the brain, because it has been banned largely in the United States and some other countries for the last couple decades, as we mentioned. So this is kind of a problem. We've got this thing on our hands. Everybody knows about it. Mm-hmm. We have a general understanding of it, but we haven't done the research.
Yeah, and we've touched on this when we've talked about marijuana, psilocybin, as well as MDMA. You have these substances that just became banned. Research into their properties.
Right.
Was at the very least professionally taboo for so long. So, yeah, despite the fact that they clearly have powerful properties, we don't necessarily understand them all that much. It's believed that LSD works similar to serotonin, a neurotransmitter responsible for regulating moods, appetite, muscle control, sexuality, sleep, and sensory perception. And LSD seems to interfere with the way the brain's serotonin receptors work. So it may inhibit neurotransmission, stimulate it, or both. It also affects the way that the retinas process information and conduct that information to the brain.
So you might be listening to this and saying, well, hold on, I've never taken any of this stuff before, and you're just kind of throwing these terms around. What's the difference between LSD and psilocybin? Well, psilocybin is a fungi, and that's classified by botanists and mycologists, people who study mushrooms. While they were used by the Aztecs in religious rituals, the American public didn't really find out about psilocybin until 1957. And this was when an article in Life magazine recounted the adventures of a New York banker in Mexico where he tried it.
Huh.
Yeah. LSD, totally different. It is colorless, odorless, and tasteless. And ingesting just 25 micrograms is enough to feel effects. Now, to give you an idea of what 25 micrograms is, that's less than the weight of 2 salt grains. It is very quickly metabolized by the human body. Now, as previously established, LSD is a chemical that's synthesized in a laboratory setting, whereas psilocybin is a fungi that's grown in nature.
One is natural, one is created in a lab.
Several chemicals that could go into LSD are currently sales restricted here in America or are monitored by the Drug Enforcement Agency. And there's all kinds of different recipes on how to make it. Some start with lysergic acid that's derived from morning glory seeds. Others use that ergot fungus that we talked about earlier and how it was discovered. They culture that and they extract ergot alkaloids from it. This fungus and LSD itself can break down when exposed to light, and that's important to note as well. In this ergot recipe, the solvents and reagents involved are also very dangerous. They're poisonous, carcinogenic, and explosive. So it's fun, I would imagine, working on this stuff. Like if you've got your little laboratory, you've got to be really careful.
Yeah.
You know, this is like some Jesse and Walter White stuff where you've got to be really careful about what kind of stuff you're concocting and what you're breathing in and whether or not you blow up your trailer.
Yeah, I mean, this is straight up chemistry. And that's the other difference. Psilocybin is ultimately it's about I guess scavenging or growing a naturally occurring organism. This is chemistry.
So the way you do it is you synthesize the ergot alkaloid into a lysergic acid compound, and you do this by adding chemicals and applying heat. Afterward, you isomerize the compound so that the atoms in its molecules rearrange. This involves some cooling, mixing it with an acid, an actual acid, not the term acid, also a base, and then evaporating it. The remnants are iOS lysergic diethylamide, which is then isomerized again, and that produces what's called active LSD. So finally, you purify it, you crystallize it. Afterward, LSD can be made into tablets, or it's dissolved into liquid, or made into gelatin squares. Most often, it's dissolved into ethanol, and then that ethanol is added to sheets of blotting paper that are then dried, cut up into little pieces, and people get tabs that
way. Yeah, it looks just like the candy that you can buy. I'm not really sure on the history of that candy. You know, the one where it basically looks like blotter acid?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, which came first?
That's a good question.
Is this like candy cigarettes, or is it just a happy coincidence that this terrible candy looks like acid?
Yeah, that is curious. If any listeners know, please let us in on the secret there. A lot of you have probably also heard about bad trips. We mentioned them earlier. Well, it's not really clear what causes these bad trips, but they result in fear and paranoia, and treatment usually requires basically going to a quiet space so that the user can just come down. But sometimes you have to administer anti-anxiety medication or tranquilizers. So that's important to remember as well.
Yeah, this makes me think of a lot of the research involving psilocybin that really ultimately kind of backs up some of what Leary said in that bit that I read, in that a lot of it comes down to priming, preparing the individual for what the trip is going to consist of.
Yeah.
And then, of course, personal medical and personal psychiatric history is going to play into that scenario
as well. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, you've also probably heard of flashbacks, right? This is the other thing, like when I was in high school, like all the legends, it was like, oh, he's going to see those white gorillas every year for the rest of his life, right? Like something like that.
Oh, yeah. This is something that is that pops up in films and TV from time to time. And it's either just completely ridiculous, like the white gorillas, or even when it is a lot cooler and more believable, say with the first season of True Detective.
Yeah, right.
There's still a lot of doubts from some individuals as to what extent this is a thing or a realistic depiction of it, if it is.
Yeah, here's the deal with flashbacks. There's no evidence to support the idea that LSD remains in your body forever in amounts inside your brain or spinal fluid. People say that, but we don't have any evidence on it. Why? Because we really haven't been able to study it, right? Some people think, though, that this is what causes flashbacks. The majority of users, though, report never having had flashbacks. And of those who have reported it, Many are mentally ill, and some doctors believe that what they're perceiving is actually a form of psychosis that emerged due to the LSD use. There's actually a medically recognized disorder called hallucinogen persisting perceptive disorder, and this is for people who constantly experience visual hallucinations after they take LSD. So this is a little different than the idea of flashbacks.
Right. I mean, it's also worth noting that visual hallucinations can occur for a number of reasons. So it's entirely possible that one could take LSD, and then what, a year later they experience some sort of visual hallucination, and one of the main ways they can describe it is the narrative of acid flashbacks.
Yeah.
And then they're going, and then that becomes encoded in memory.
So one last thing I want to make clear about LSD before we cap off this summary here. LSD is not an addictive drug. So if somebody tells you, you know, oh, you're going to take that, you're going to get hooked on it or something like that, that's just patently untrue. The real basic way that it works is that if you take it a lot, your body is going to get used to it, and subsequently the effects are going to lessen over time. So that's the opposite of something that you become addicted to. It doesn't work in the same way as something like heroin.
Right. Though some people may point out there's the whole idea that like the first time you take heroin is the best, and then you're always chasing that dragon. But still, the LSD, psilocybin, DMT, any of these psychedelic substances that we've discussed on the program before, they are not addictive in the very literal way that stuff like heroin is. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about psychedelics. And in particular, we're going to talk about psychedelics in medicine.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product, and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99.
Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back.
So according to Timothy Leary's archivist, a guy named Michael Horowitz, before Leary, the research being done on psychedelics was mostly done by the CIA and the Army.
Ah, makes us think of John C. Lilly again.
And Stranger Things, yeah. But they were looking to weaponize it, dosing subjects without their knowledge. Now, what he's actually talking about is the CIA's attempts with stuff like Project Bluebird and Project MKUltra to develop mind control techniques. We actually have an episode about Stranger Things coming up in the next couple of weeks where we're going to talk more about this stuff. The basic idea here, though, I'm going to boil it down quickly, is that they were inspired by Nazi research experiments in the Dachau concentration camp. Subsequently, they tested on helpless populations like prisoners, drug addicts, and mental patients. And at one point, the government reportedly ordered over 100 million doses of LSD from Sandoz, that company that discovered it, so that they could experiment with contaminating a water supply. So they wanted to weaponize this and basically see, like, can we put a whole bunch of LSD in one of our enemy's water supplies?
You know, this really sad thing about this portion of the story is that it underlies a fact about military first research, that essentially military researchers come in and say, okay, can we use it to kill people better? Can we use it to enable our warfare in some way, shape, or form? And if not, well, then we're done with it.
We see this time and time again on the show whenever we dig deep into topics, whether it be the weaponization of animals we've done an episode on, or a lot of our space-based stuff is usually related to weaponizing space in some way. So actually, the government – Sandoz wouldn't supply them with that much, so they turned to another company. They wanted the company to break Sandoz's patent and produce the chemical, but the whole thing never came to pass, and the government essentially deemed LSD too unpredictable for their general use. Now, Leary pioneered research into how psychedelics could reveal the nature of human consciousness and possibly help people with depression and anxiety. But he also precipitated a backlash against psychedelics that criminalized them and made it impossible for others to do research on them. Leary supporters argue that's not Leary's fault. This would have happened anyways.
You know, and I can see I can see both sides of that. But he was undoubtedly a key figure and in a very ultimately a very like hateable figure. Like part of his charisma and his charm, it just worked like poison against people who already had a conservative bent.
Yeah, it's true. And we're going to see time and time again people turn against him, and not the kind of people that you would expect, right? So let's back up for a second here. What about before Leary? How were scientists and researchers looking at it before that? Well, in the 1950s, some researchers began investigating whether psychedelics could treat mental health disorders or addiction. The federal government funded 116 of these studies between 1953 and 1973. Again, I turn to our episode on MDMA and Sasha and Ann Shulgin. They are a perfect example of this. Along those lines is kind of what was going on with psychiatrists and various researchers working with LSD in patients to see how it could work. Sandoz was essentially selling it as a psychiatric product.
Right. And these were reputable research operations.
Yep.
We had not yet gotten to the point where Leary comes along or John C. Lilly comes along and starts giving it to dolphins.
Yeah, exactly. Or giving it to himself while he's hanging out with dolphins. Now, the Sandoz company patented it, but they sold it as Delicid beginning in 1947, and they sold it in 25 microgram tablets that were designed for analytical psychotherapy. They suggested that the psychiatrists themselves take it so that they could better understand their patients' experiences. Now, when they stopped making it, they said, this is about the fact that there's a lack of regulation and that there's inaccurate information being perpetuated about this drug. But between 1950 and 1965, 40,000 patients were given Delicid tablets, basically legal LSD. Hmm. And Dr. Max Rinkel was the first to bring LSD to the United States and then test it on a population of 100 volunteers. He and his colleague, Dr. Paul Hoke, noted that LSD produced effects that, quote, mimicked schizophrenic psychosis. So this is, you can see where there's some, as another theme that we come back to over and over again on the show is like early psychological theory seems to be very generalized and biased, right? And this is another example of that. They're like, oh, there's this thing. It just seems to make you schizophrenic, you know, and there just wasn't enough research behind it. But recreational drug use increased dramatically in the 60s, such that as many as 2 million people had dropped acid by the 1970s. So by 1965, there were very few researchers who were allowed to possess LSD. Only six projects were conducted in 1969. In 1970, the U.S. Congress added psychedelics into the government war on drugs, and the federal government declared these drugs had no medical use. The chairman for New Jersey's Narcotic Drug Study Commission called LSD the greatest threat facing the country today, more dangerous than the Vietnam War. Seems like a little hyperbole
in
retrospect.
I think so, yes.
By 1974, the National Institutes for Mental Health declared that LSD had, quote, no real therapeutic value. So there was a strong establishment bent against this drug, which Timothy Leary unfortunately did not help with his antics. Today, though, LSD is a Schedule I drug in the United States. It's under the Controlled Substances Act. This basically means the government believes that it has high abuse potential, which we've already established that it's not addictive. It has a lack of accepted safe uses when taken under medical supervision. We'll talk a little bit about how there actually are some of those. And that it basically has no current medical use in their minds.
Now,
again, there's evidence that it does.
Now, I want to remind everybody that by placing it as a Schedule I, they are placing it in the same category as marijuana, and they're placing it in a stricter category than Category 2, which includes cocaine.
Yep. So since then, only a small number of studies have been conducted. You've got small sample sizes, so there's not a lot of research that we can rely on. The early results are broad. They suggest that when used by people without a family history or risk of psychological problems, psychedelics can actually make us kinder, calmer, and better at our jobs. They also help us solve problems more creatively and make us more open-minded and generous.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the research here about these potential uses for psychedelics. One is instantly reminded of meditation, because both meditation and psilocybin have been shown to shut down the default mode network, that constant stream of worry chat about past and future in your brain. And the brain activity is similar, even if the experience, obviously isn't going to always be the same. Though, there is often a certain amount of crossover. And we'll have to get into that more when we do a focus on meditation in the future.
Yeah. I mean, what Robert's referring to is the default mode network. This is a group of structures in the brain. They're found in the frontal and prefrontal cortex. That's what's responsible for our ego and our sense of self. And it's why we as humans have very rigid, habitual thinking that, let's face it, we can obsess over, right?
Yeah.
On psychedelics, that slows down and the boundaries between the self and the world dissolve, allowing for therapy sessions that can be more effective.
Yeah. There are a number of excellent studies here. A 2011 study at Johns Hopkins University gave high doses of psilocybin to 51 test subjects. And according to ABC News, 30 of these individuals experienced measurable personality changes that lasted more than a year.
So as of 2016, a year ago, about 500 people have participated in formal psilocybin experience. That's not LSD. It's worth remembering, though, that these volunteers are self-selected and are carefully screened and then are guided by therapists. So psychedelics used outside of control settings, yes, they can cause problems, including bad trips where the users feel extremely anxious and depressed. This doesn't account for the occasional flashbacks that we talked about earlier, whether that's a real thing or not, right? The possible future of research is very promising. Patients are recommended for treatment by a doctor, for instance. This might be what we look at in a few years, right? You get recommended for LSD or psilocybin treatment by your doctor. They get you screened for mental illness. They look at your heart to see if you have any heart conditions. Then they're prepping you about what to expect. You're monitored by a medical professional while you're under the effects. This is someone that they have, established a trusting relationship with you. It's not just some scary orderly who stands there the whole time. They have to work with you for at least 6 to 8 hours ahead of time. Then the experience you have is contained, so it's something you can build a life around, right? You can figure out how to solve the problems that you're going in for around this.
Across the board, though, we're looking at openness as one of the key positive results of psilocybin use, other hallucinogens that have been explored in these various research programs.
Yeah, and so you look at what are the possibilities here. If we can get the FDA to reschedule it, what can we do with it? Well, there have already been studies that have looked at how psilocybin or LSD can be used to help terminal patients deal with end-of-life anxiety. You can potentially help people who have addictive problems. There's been studies that have been done on smoking cessation and alcoholism related to it. And then also, psychedelics can potentially help mental wellness. There's been a number of studies that have been done basically looking at how it can prolong positive changes in attitude and mood. When I think about LSD or psilocybin for myself, I've never taken either. But when I hear these very controlled laboratory conditions described, as somebody who's never taken it, that's actually more appealing to me, the idea of it being done in a controlled setting like that.
The crazy part about it is that, like, the idea of say, people or young people taking LSD, psilocybin, or whatever, and not really knowing what they're doing and having, maybe a positive experience, maybe a negative, like, that's not in keeping, A, with the clinical use of it, but B, with the traditional use of some of these substances.
Yeah.
Where you would have not a scientist, but a shaman to administer these things. There were rituals, there was a process.
It was communal.
Yeah, it was a communal experience with lots of priming.
Yeah. Now, so just from my perspective, because I know I have a history of depression and anxiety and my family has a history of depression and anxiety, I've always worried, well, I don't want to take this because I might have a bad reaction, right? Remember what they said some of the setup was, is they needed to screen you for certain things. I'm also curious, though, they say things like it's going to increase your interest in fantasy and imagination. And I want to know how much more interested in fantasy and imagination I can get, because I'm already pretty well down that rabbit hole. One of the things that these researchers say is that when they take a look at it, it can help change your personality if you're having personality problems, right? The general idea is that personality is fixed after the age of 30, but with the help of psychedelics, you may be able to overcome some, boundaries that you're facing in that respect. And I just think that's interesting. I've always just kind of anecdotally thought about it about 10 years later than that. Like, pretty much everybody I know, by the time they're 40, they are who they are and they're going to be that way. I have not seen anybody make any drastic changes, but it seems like if they have really difficult emotional problems in life that they're trying to get over, it seems like there's a possibility here that if we were only able to study this further, it might be an option for people like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one of those things where, we may think of ourselves as set in stone after a certain point, but we're not really. I mean, we know that the mind is and memory is more malleable than that. So psychedelics come in as a possible means to loosen things up so that they can be reset. And of course, that being said, drugs are not the only thing that I think that they can allow a person to do that. I mean, sometimes something as simple as, say, travel, new experiences, reading a book you wouldn't have otherwise read, this sort of thing, and generally having a curiosity about life, can change who you are. I think one of the interesting things in some of these studies is that it makes you wonder, like, is the person that is administered the substance, are they the kind of person that is not a novelty seeker? They don't seek out new experiences otherwise. Like, maybe that's the kind of individual for whom some potential future treatment would be best used. Like, somebody who really can't shake something negative in their life,
And they have a pretty established routine of how things are, but at the same time, they recognize that there's something about that routine that is dysfunctional for them or for the world around them.
Yeah, there's some sort of cycle that needs to be broken. There's something that needs to be, just pulled apart so it can be put back together in a slightly different form.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good way to approach it. So why don't we take another break, and then when we get back, we're going to officially dive in to the Leary stuff, and we're going to start right at the beginning.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, we're back. Okay, so we're going to talk about Timothy Leary for the rest of this episode and then into the next episode as well. We're going to start at the beginning because I think a lot of the stuff that happens on early on in his life is going to be key. And it's interesting when we talk about this in terms of like at what point is someone's personality set? At what point is somebody's destiny kind of set? According to Robert Greenfield, who wrote Timothy Leary, a biography, you can sort of see a lot of that in Leary's early life. So he was born October 26, 1920 in Springfield, Massachusetts, to an Irish Catholic family. His father was a struggling dentist, and his mother was a working mother.
That's my neck of the woods, Springfield, Massachusetts. Yeah, my uncle works there. My whole family's from the western part of that state, so I have a very clear picture in my head now of what his young upbringing was like.
So according to Greenfield's biography, you can really attribute a lot of Leary's rebellious spirit to his relationship with his father, Tote, an alcoholic who brought imbalance to the home and depended on charity from family loans to prop up his struggling dental practice. Now, the young Tim Leary, occasionally stood up to his father, but was also forced to hide from him on the roof on some occasions. And then Tote left the family when Tim was only 14, leaving him to find solace in books about mythic heroes and legends. And he was determined to become something better, greater than his father, and his mother obsessed as well over her child's future. Like, how can I engineer somebody for success? And so Greenfield argues that we see the seeds of Leary's relationships with authority figures throughout his life, pinpointed in his early life, as well as his relationships with women. He would go through periods of finding structure within an institution, but would ultimately rebel against its order. And in times of distress, he'd seek out women. And for positive father figures, he turned to not to his own father, of course, but to flamboyant and sometimes dramatic family members. And he depended on the emotional and financial support, first of all, of his mother. And Greenfield identifies a pattern of his leaving most of them along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think like one of the awful themes that we're going to notice by the time we get to the end of this two-parter is that he left a wake behind him of either abused people or dead people. I mean, we're going to get into it.
Yeah, there are a number of self-destructive tendencies in Timothy Leary's life. All right, so in terms of his school and his essentially pre-psychedelics career, Leary attended classical high school alongside American author and biographer and historian William Manchester. Some of you might be familiar with him from A World Lit Only by Fire, The Medieval Mind and the Renaissance, which is an excellent book. And he also went to the same school as Theodore Geisel or Dr. Seuss.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the College of Holy Cross in Worcester. This is a strict Catholic school that, of course, inspired rebellion from Leary. He made money gambling on sports. He frequently hopped the wall with other adventure seekers in order to go out drinking in town and chase girls.
Mm. My father...
Yeah.
From Worcester. So also like this is like connecting the dots. So to give you an idea here, if you're not familiar with Massachusetts at all, Springfield's in the western part of the state. Worcester's sort of in the middle between Springfield and Boston.
Okay.
So it's not – I mean it's like 45 minutes probably from where he grew up.
All right. Well, the next place we're going on the map here for Leary is West Point. And this is where he initially just goes all in on the culture of West Point. According to Greenfield, he's writing back to his mom with just the maximum amount of West Point lingo you can possibly use. And this is telling, too. Like, he'll start off really into a culture, and then he rebels. And indeed, he does. He returns to his old ways. He even faces a court-martial for drunken behavior. He's acquitted, but then he ends up facing what's known as the silence, or was known as the silence. This was a policy that ostracized cadets who broke the honor code. And this was discontinued in 73. And he ultimately ends up resigning and is honorably discharged by the Army. Then he applies to colleges across America. The University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa accepted him first, so that's where he went. He met Dr. Donald Angus Ramsdell, a Harvard psychology PhD, a man who Leary would later refer to as Dr. D, which I found
that's
interesting
given our episodes on the real Dr. John D.
Yeah. And he soon immersed himself in the study of psychology and biology. And now having lost his draft deferment, he enrolled in ROTC to avoid the draft. And then he also ran afoul of the school here due to womanizing, so much so that the dean even accused him of sullying, quote, the honor of Southern womanhood, and he was expelled.
Man, like just from my perspective, from, you know, being from up in New England and in the 2000s, mm-hmm. moving to the South into a progressive Southern city, I had a lot of culture shock. I'm trying to imagine what it was like for this guy, all these years ago, just transitioning and jumping around and getting into trouble and just really shaking things up everywhere he went.
Well, it's interesting. One of the sort of side things in Greenfield's biography that he points out is that apparently at the time, the university in Tuscaloosa, you had these various liberal academics and in many cases homosexual academics mm-hmm. who had found sort of a safe environment in which to thrive. So in a sense, like if Timothy Leary was going to go to anywhere in the American South at that point, Tuscaloosa was probably one of the places to go. And he did find people who valued him and embraced him, initially.
But he wasn't quite able to finish his academic duties.
Oh, of course not. Now, on the advice of Dr. D, he goes on to enroll in the University of Illinois. He lines up work in the psychology department, and he eventually completes his education at Tuscaloosa remotely. But, it's one of these situations where You just see this pattern over and over again. As Greenfield writes, a clear pattern in his life had already emerged. Whenever Tim Leary began accepting the kind of success for which he had been programmed since birth by his mother, he would stop the process by indulging, just as his father had done before him, in self-destructive behavior.
So Leary then goes on to get his master's degree at the University of Washington. We're talking about Washington State now. So he's already jumped from New England to Alabama to Illinois, and now up to Washington State. He received his doctorate in psychology in 1950 from the University of California at Berkeley. So then he jumps down to California. Here he decided that conventional psychotherapy was useless, and he began experimenting with group therapy and transactional analysis. So this gives you an idea of like where he was at sort of academically, discipline-wise, before he was introduced to psychedelics. His first wife, Marianne, committed suicide during this time. This was in 1955. This left him to raise their two children alone. We have more on this, obviously.
This was just a real sad situation for a number of reasons. But basically, he and Marianne had a very
open relationship.
Well, yeah, but also just a chaotic relationship. But just a lot of, according to Greenfield's account in the biography, just a lot of negative vibes in this relationship. A lot was not working. Leary was apparently looking to end the relationship in the very near future anyway. And then she committed suicide. And it was, you know, it's not like Leary wasn't an unfeeling person.
Right.
Like this had a huge effect on him. Like he would write about it. It's just essentially a pit that he wasn't able to emerge from emotionally for decades even. And then, you know, to say nothing then of the children as well.
Now, the urban legend of this goes, this is what, you know, I can't imagine how many articles and books Robert and I read for this, but it probably popped up in every single one of them, is that the night before they were having an argument about their open relationship and about that he was in a relationship with a woman that he loved more than Marianne, his wife, mm-hmm. and that she was upset about this and she wanted him to break it off. And he went into the bedroom and said, "It's your problem, not mine," and closed the door. When he woke up in the morning, she was dead. She had suffocated herself in the garage inside the family car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Greenfield's account, he kind of points to the different versions of the story. So like there's like a slightly different version that he tells the authorities, and then he writes about later, and you know you can sort of try to find the truth between all of these, and yeah, it's just a really ugly situation with an ugly ending.
It
for
is,
her.
But it's also unfortunately, I think, an important sign of things to come with this guy, mm-hmm. and sort of where his priorities were, right? And I don't want to end this episode because we're about to wrap up our first part here, but I don't want to end it on such a super downer. He went on afterwards to teach at Berkeley, and he actually was the director of psychological research at the Kaiser Foundation Hospital in Oakland, California from 1955 until 1958.
Now, during this period, after his wife's suicide, he also ends up going to Europe a few times. He goes to Spain, he goes to Italy, and this is kind of key. There was this period of time when he was in Spain, and he suddenly experienced this some sort of a mysterious illness. So swelling, pain. He was attended to by a Danish doctor, and he ends up passing this night in misery. Ends up sending the kids to stay with another couple of Americans who were staying close by. And he said that he felt like he died during this time, that he let go and he put the past behind him. But in a very interesting way, it was kind of his first psychedelic experience, like a taste of this altered state. Not to be confused with all the times he'd gotten just blindly drunk in the past, because he had previously and for a lot of his life had a severe alcohol problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's shortly after that too that Frank Barron, who was a colleague from Berkeley, he visited Leary during an unproductive stay in Florence, Italy. He was always going on these trips to try and to write various things. And at this point, Barron told him that during his research into creativity, he'd interviewed a psychiatrist who had used magic mushrooms to produce visions and trances, and that Barron had tried them as well, resulting in a mystical transcendental insight. Now, interestingly enough, Leary warned him that he might lose his scientific credibility if he babbled on about this sort of thing.
and that, my friends, is what we call foreshadowing.
Yes. So in the next episode, we will get into the psychedelic experience of Leary, basically one continuous psychedelic experience that lasted his entire life and basically dragged American culture with it.
Yeah, please make sure that you tune into that second part. It's got a lot more of the juicy details of Timothy Leary's life and the science and research that he did into LSD and psilocybin. If you want to reach out to us about this episode and any of the stuff we brought up today regarding LSD research or possibly Timothy Leary's history, you can always get us on social media. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Tumblr, and we are on Instagram.
And if you want to get in touch with us the old-fashioned way, just shoot us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.